From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, who suffered a debilitating stroke Wednesday, has played a critical and constantly evolving role in modern Middle East history. With his illness, the future of his brand new party, Kadima, and the peace process itself are left in flux. Also unclear is his legacy. For the first rough draft of history, we turn once again to Susan Caskey, international editor of The Week magazine, with a review of press reaction around the world. Welcome back.
It's good to be here.
Susan, as of early this week, the newspapers were writing about Sharon, but it wasn't about his health. It was about the corruption scandal swirling around his administration.
That's right. In fact, the corruption scandal, which involves not only Sharon but other members of his family, had been the main topic of Israeli editorial pages early in the week. In fact, his eldest son, Omri Sharon, resigned from the Knesset on Tuesday. On Wednesday, many editorials were talking about the scandal and speculating about whether Sharon was going to be indicted and whether or not he would be implicated in taking bribes. This all has to do with campaign fundraising from back when Sharon was leading the Likud party. And then the stroke happened on Wednesday night, and it was so late in the evening that the Israeli papers had already been put to bed. So Thursday, when people woke up, they heard on the radio that Sharon was in dire, dire condition and was undergoing surgery. But what they read in the papers was more criticism of the scandal and speculation that he might have to step down from this new centrist party, the Kadima party, before the elections.
Did people immediately jump into the ramifications of losing Ariel Sharon?
Absolutely. The very next day, the papers were already full of headlines saying this is the post-Sharon era. And there you find the diversity of opinion that Israeli papers are so famous for. We had everything from complete pessimism, which you saw in the Jerusalem Post. There were editorials there saying, Kadima, this new centrist party, they'll be squabbling over the leadership. Another editorial there called it a party in diapers, children who have now been orphaned. For the rest of the papers that I was looking at, we saw a kind of stoicism. Haaretz had an editorial, that's a paper out of Tel Aviv, it's more left, saying, look, Kadima is going to continue on. Israel has moved to the center, and they will rally around this idea that we need a centrist party even without Sharon. It's about a vision. It's about unilateral disengagement from the Palestinians, and we do have an agenda. The European papers are much more pessimistic than the Israeli papers have been. Headline after headline is saying, you know, catastrophe in Israel and Israel in turmoil. Let's see, the Süddeutsche Zeitung, which is from Munich, Germany, says that you can expect to see militants from the Palestinians coming and attacking Israel now and exploiting this weakness. In the Czech Republic, the main daily there, Mladá Fronta Dnes, just completely has a sort of woe, alas, editorial saying Sharon's obituary will be the obituary of peace in the Middle East.
I'm curious whether those on the right in Israel are expressing any glee that the peace process that he has taken this far seems to be so much in jeopardy.
I probably shouldn't have been surprised, but I was somewhat surprised to see a report in Ma'ariv saying that the extreme right-wing settlers who protested the withdrawal of all troops and settlements from Gaza 6 months ago, they talked to reporters. In fact, one of the organizers of the ceremony, Michael Ben-Horin, said, quote, we explicitly asked the angels of destruction to remove Sharon from the picture, and that is precisely what has happened.
Pat Robertson, I think on his 700 Club, expressed almost identical sentiments that this was the wrath of the Lord. What about on the Palestinian side? What has the press there and elsewhere in the Arab world had to say?
in Al-Quds Al-Arabi, which is based in London, but it's mostly Palestinian-run and it's distributed across the Arab world. They have a news story talking about how Palestinians in the territories are celebrating already, and they are passing out candy. And in an editorial there, the paper says, "It's not surprising that some frustrated Palestinians celebrate Sharon's stroke. The man was a horrible and bloody nightmare for them." Then over in Jordan, one of the centrist papers there, Al-Gad, had an editorial saying, "Sharon will not find mourners in the Arab world," because the image he built throughout his political and military career was that of a man of war. And that has been echoed through several other Arab editorials. Many Western commentators have been talking about Sharon's seeming transformation into a man of peace, and the Arab papers were not buying that.
As you look at the coverage, is there any way to divine at this stage how Sharon eventually will be viewed by history?
So far from what the media is saying, I think it's going to be so complicated. He's such a big figure and a complex one. It's interesting because I did look at one Jordanian editorial which was criticizing Sharon and saying, you know, we're not going to miss this man at all. He was a disaster for Palestinians and for Arabs. But then it went on to say, you know, we have to admire him because it says, "Courage and objectivity require us to admit that Ariel Sharon has lived all his life for his people's benefit. If he were an Arab leader and behaved as he has done in Israel, he would have been the idol of the masses."
Okay, Susan. Well, as always, thank you very much.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Susan Caskey is international editor of The Week magazine.
Just to reiterate, as of this recording, Ariel Sharon is still in the hospital after a 7-hour operation on his brain. Meanwhile, in the Israeli media, there's a growing acceptance of the fact that he will probably never return to public life. Amitz Asael is a senior commentator for the Jerusalem Post. As he reviewed Sharon's relationship with the media on Thursday, he reflected on how his own opinion of the man had changed dramatically over the years.
In 1982, back home, after having been enlisted as a soldier, I took part in demonstrations that demanded his removal. He represented many things that I found extremely dangerous. And then decades later, I found him suddenly implementing policies which I supported. Eventually, I came to agree with almost his every move.
Sharon's public life is almost as long as the life of Israel. How would you characterize his changing image?
I would say he began as a Tarzan and later developed into a Santa Claus type of grandfather figure. Initially in the 50s, he was celebrated and glorified because he addressed a pressing need. The country was extremely vulnerable and hundreds of people were being killed by terrorists. A military response to this situation was imperative, and Israel was very young and its military very embryonic, and it lacked such a response until Ariel Sharon, well before he turned 30, offered that response with a very small but extremely elite unit that he created, trained, and shaped.
In his early days as a politician, he was instrumental in taking Israel to war with Lebanon, which split Israeli public opinion. I guess Tarzan became a darker and darker character at that point?
Ever since. The Lebanon War in general and the massacres in Sabra and Shatila in particular.
Sabra and Shatila were refugee camps.
Yes. He is often depicted as a Dracula. I don't mean metaphorically. I mean there really were frequently caricatures worldwide which depicted him as a bloodthirsty murderer. For most of the leading opinion makers, the senior columnists in the Israeli media, he became a political pariah and a journalistic anathema.
So then how did he transform himself politically and through the media?
Two things happened. The first was done not by him, but by Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat imposed on Israel such a vicious terror war that people, when they still perceived Sharon as a man of war, they suddenly said, this man of war is what we need now.
By terror war, you're referring to the Second Intifada?
I'm referring to all of the violence that followed the Camp David summit of summer 2000. This is why he was elected in the first place. People forget that. He was elected not in order to make peace, but in order to win a war, which he did.
You said there were two things that happened.
The second, of course, was the disengagement.
To disengage from Gaza.
Yes, which was already the latter part of his premiership. He was seasoned. He knew exactly what he wanted to accomplish with the media, and he did that. When he decided to launch the disengagement plan, he invited to his ranch one particular columnist, the most veteran columnist for the leading daily Haaretz. His name is Yoel Marcus. He invited him to his ranch and shared with him his plan, and this is how the scoop came out, completely engineered by Sharon. Sharon knew that this way he's immediately winning over the support of the leading daily, and he accomplished that.
I wonder if you could describe to me the everyday working relationship between the media and politicians in Israel.
It's a very intimate relationship. Many journalists hobnob on a regular daily basis with senior politicians. They share the same cafeteria in the Israeli parliament. They have each other's cell phones. As executive editor of the Jerusalem Post, I would get phone calls from Ehud Olmert personally at the time as Sharon's deputy in order to discuss this or that item that appeared that morning in our paper. I think it's inconceivable in America that, say, Dick Cheney would call somebody in this or that paper and discuss with him the morning's coverage. In Israel, it's done that way.
And in fact, as you say, in America, in Washington, that would be unheard of. But journalists, many of them, would pay dearly for that kind of access. And sometimes when journalists get something approaching that kind of access in Washington, they're accused of pulling their punches. Does that happen in Israel?
No. That is not what this is about. Israeli journalists have brought down one president and several prime ministers. Yitzhak Rabin, in his first term in office, was made to resign. And this was done by a journalist who had an intimate relationship with him as prime minister.
I wonder if, when the obituaries are written, whether we'll recognize the same man from newspaper to newspaper. Will he in one paper be regarded as a potential bringer of peace, and in another newspaper as a betrayer of his people?
No, I don't think anyone will portray him as a traitor. There will, however, be people who will claim that the damage that he leaves behind him is greater than the benefits. I personally disagree with that, and in fact helped lead the Jerusalem Post's own attitude towards the conflict with the Palestinians from what a decade ago was a relatively right-wing position into a centrist position that wholeheartedly supported Sharon's disengagement plan. But I do realize, while these are my views, that who knows, maybe a generation from now, history will prove me wrong.
All right. Amitz, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Amitz Asael is senior commentator for the Jerusalem Post.
Coming up, good news travels fast in mining country. Bad news arrives past deadline. And a new leak case raises new questions.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In a world aching for good news, this was just the tonic. After 42 hours in a subterranean death trap, 12 West Virginia miners were okay.
God can make miracles happen.
Family and friends flocked back to the church.
I ran barefooted to the church.
Leaving the church, Governor Manchin gave a thumbs up.
But then a horrifying turn of events. If you were awake 3 o'clock Wednesday morning and tuned to CNN, you learned that the men were dead after all.
And I think they said the other 11 couldn't be saved. I don't know if that's for sure that they're perished or not, but I do know only one is
This is unbelievable.
It's totally, it's the worst thing that I've ever heard. I don't know how that this information could get this far.
Still, fate was not finished twisting. Later that morning, most of America awakened to the wrong story, the earlier saga of miraculous survival repeated in front page headlines around the country. The news cycle had betrayed them as papers rolled off the presses with stories of death cheated in a jubilant small town. It seemed careless and irresponsible, but it wasn't that. The spurious reports were based on official pronouncements and their very real euphoric effects. If there was any scandal, it was that the mining company officials, reasonably certain of their employees' true fate at a much earlier hour, didn't step forward immediately to discredit or at least question the supposed miracle. This was not a Dewey defeats Truman moment, based on faulty journalistic assumption. It was more like the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and the so-called Jenine massacre, in which the reliance on official sources merely reflected the occasional unreliability of officialdom. We learn once again that those in charge don't necessarily know what's going on, and sometimes they tell less than they know. There's a temptation, too, to see this as some sort of zeitgeist episode, the failure of the old media paradigm in the face of new technology. But it isn't that, either. Newspapers have been vulnerable to fast-breaking events since the first one was published. Live broadcasting is immediate, but it certainly isn't new. The miracle that wasn't is no more than a tragic convergence of official misinformation and the tyranny of the clock. You can't print a paper at 2 a.m. that lands on the reader's doorstep reflecting up-to-the-minute reality. The Fourth Estate was simply trapped in the fourth dimension, the inescapability of time. The real miracle is that it doesn't happen more often.
On December 16th, after holding it for more than a year, the New York Times ran a story by James Risen and Eric Lichtblau that disclosed the president had authorized the National Security Agency to wiretap people in the U.S. without court warrants. Reportedly, the president met with the Times in a last-ditch effort to stop the story, but once it was published, the president, his vice president, and his press secretary came out swinging.
This is a limited program designed to prevent attacks on the United States of America. And I repeat, limited. I think most Americans understand the need to find out what the enemy's thinking.
In the days following 9/11, was to authorize the National Security Agency to intercept a certain category of terrorist-linked international communications. There are no communications more important to the safety of the United States than those related to al-Qaeda that have one end in the United States. If we'd been able to do this before 9/11,
this is a vital tool in our efforts to save lives and prevent attacks from happening. It is very limited in nature. We are a nation that is at war. The president is the commander-in-chief, and after the attacks of September 11th, he made a very firm commitment to the American people.
2 weeks later, the Justice Department announced it would launch an investigation into who leaked the existence of the secret program to the press. It's a tricky case, because while defenders of the program deem the leaker a lawbreaker, others regard him or her as a constitutionally protected whistleblower. Here's reporter James Risen talking with Katie Couric this week.
In this case, I've been a reporter for about 25 years. This was the purest case of a whistleblowers coming forward, people who truly believed that there was something wrong going on in the government, and they were motivated, I believe, by the purest reasons to come forward.
But many critics have also...
Whether James Risen's source was a traitor or a patriot makes all the difference for that reporter's role in the leak investigation. It could be a replay of the Valerie Plame case, where the judge didn't buy reporters' claims that they have a right to protect their sources. Or it could be a new game altogether. University of Chicago law professor Jeffrey Stone has joined us before to parse the reporter's privilege to protect sources, so I asked him what he thinks will happen next.
They will pursue the leaker because it is their belief
that this was a criminal offense, that is, the disclosure of the information was a criminal offense. Putting aside the reporter, let's assume they identify the leaker by an internal investigation. If they believe this is criminal, they will file an indictment, and the lawyer for the defendants will then move to dismiss the indictment on the ground that they did not commit a criminal offense because they had a First Amendment right to disclose the information, and that's how that issue will be decided. If we're talking about the reporter privilege, it's more complicated. So the second variation is the Department of Justice doesn't know who the leaker was. And so they call James Risen to the grand jury and they say, tell us who your source was. And James Risen says, no, I refuse to do that. In that context, James Risen is in trouble because there is no federal reporter's privilege. So the most likely outcome, in my view, is that the Department of Justice, if they don't identify the source without having to call Risen, they will call him. They will bring him to a grand jury. He will claim that he does not have to disclose the information, and the judge will find him in contempt.
The time was courts were reluctant to prosecute leak cases. Do you think that the Valerie Plame case and the jailing and ultimate release of New York Times reporter Judith Miller when she gave up her source has emboldened courts to act aggressively in this area and jail reporters?
Once an event like that happens, it makes it more likely that it will happen again. And so in this situation, I think that the only way that Risen would not be held in contempt if it gets to that point is if the judge decides to look into the question as to whether the NSA program itself was unlawful or unconstitutional. I don't think there's any question at all that the public employees in this situation violated the law by disclosing the information. The only question here is whether they had a constitutional right to do so.
Jeff, an editorial in the New York Times on Wednesday said, leak investigations are often designed to distract the public from the real issues by blaming the messenger. And it goes on, take the third leak inquiry into a Washington Post report on secret overseas CIA camps where prisoners are tortured or shipped to other countries for torture. The administration said the reporting had damaged America's image. Actually, the secret detentions and torture did that. What do you think? Do you agree that leak investigations are often designed as a distraction?
There's no doubt that they can be used in that way. And I also have no doubt that in the current, for example, National Security Agency spying instance, the administration is using the investigation in order to focus public attention on the disloyalty, in quotes, of the leakers and of the reporters. At the same time, that's not to suggest that having an investigation in that circumstance is in any way inappropriate. It is my view that the NSA spy program was unlawful and that what really has happened here is not a major danger to the national security, but a major danger to the credibility of the administration. And therefore, I buy into the idea that the investigation of the leakers is intended, in effect, as a way of distracting attention from what is the serious issue, indeed the most serious constitutional issue, I think, since Watergate.
If, as you say, the government has every legal right to pursue these leakers, if they believe that they are breaking the law, and if you believe that this may be the most serious constitutional breach since Watergate, do you then believe that there really needs to be a national shield law to protect reporters who are engaged in presenting the views of whistleblowers to the public to be protected from these sorts of investigations?
I believe there needs to be both a whistleblower law and a shield law that protects and facilitates sources who are otherwise anxious about disclosing information that should be disclosed to the public. What makes that statement an ambiguous one is that there are circumstances where the leaker believes that he's doing a good thing when in fact he's doing a bad thing. That's at the heart of this problem. Here, the leaker may believe that the NSA program was unlawful and unconstitutional.
And you believe that yourself.
I do believe that myself. Absolutely, I believe that. But it's also possible that I'm wrong and they were wrong, and a court may later find that. And then the problem is, well, are these people heroes or are they villains?
All right, Jeff, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Anytime, Brooke.
Jeffrey Stone is the author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime. He spoke to us from the University of Chicago. Also this week, Bill Gertz reported in the Washington Times that former NSA official Russ Tice had come forward wanting to testify about the spying program. Tice is quoted as saying in his letters to the House and Senate intelligence panels, "I intend to report to Congress probable, unlawful, and unconstitutional acts conducted while I was an intelligence officer with the National Security Agency and with the Defense Intelligence Agency."
In the immediate aftermath of September 11th's carnage, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld faced the press to deliver an important message. Not to America, not to the international community, not to the media, but to his own Defense Department. It was a warning about leaking classified information because a leaker, Rumsfeld declared, is a threat.
It's a person who's willing to violate federal criminal statutes and willing to frustrate our efforts to track down and deal with terrorists and willing to reveal information that could cause the lives of men and women in uniform.
2 weeks later, USA Today ran a page one story detailing U.S. Special Forces operations already proceeding on the ground in Afghanistan. 2 weeks after that, President Bush was so infuriated at leaks from Capitol Hill that he tried to cut off classified briefings to all but a few members of Congress.
Some members did not accept that responsibility. Somebody didn't. So I took it upon myself to notify the leadership of the Congress that I intend to protect our troops.
In the end, the president had to back off because by law the administration must keep Congress fully informed on intelligence matters. To many inside the Beltway, though, it was the president who seemed to be out of the loop. In Washington, leaking is not only business as usual, it's a way of life.
What the president was saying is, I can't believe that people are getting classified briefings and then leaking information. Come on, Mr. President. It's what happens every day.
Scott Armstrong is an investigative reporter, author, and founder of the National Security Archive, a repository of declassified information. He says leakers are not only ubiquitous, but necessary to journalism and democracy.
They're correcting things. Sometimes they're verifying things. This is how we get our information. It's an information economy.
And in the information economy, there is never a recession because there are too many journalists chasing too many bureaucrats and politicians with too many reasons to blab. One who reputedly did not blab was Leon Firth, the vice president's national security advisor in the Clinton administration and someone known for being maddeningly leak-proof. Firth says that was a matter of integrity and discipline. Discipline, however, diminishes geometrically with each additional individual entrusted with a given piece of information.
You have a small meeting. Everybody in that meeting is extremely responsible, and nobody likes leaks of sensitive information. But they all go back from that meeting to their buildings, and they feel obliged to brief at least one or two other people who are very close to them and important to them operationally. And those people, in turn, brief one or two people who are important to them operationally, and pretty soon you have traversed 6 degrees of separation, and the information has crossed the barrier and is in the public domain.
Beyond carelessness, a main category of leaks comes from disaffected insiders, bureaucrats or political appointees wishing to influence debate or expose blunders within their own agencies. And then there's a third variety, the vanity leak.
And that is that somebody has this information and just can't keep quiet about it and wants to talk about it as a way of basically showing off.
Reporters need to understand those various motivations in order to evaluate the substance of a given leak, but mainly they're concerned with the steady flow of reliable information. Bill Gertz is on the National Security beat at the Washington Times. So successful has he been in reporting classified information that he was said to be the main target of the so-called official secrets legislation introduced in, but so far unenacted by, Congress.
You know, as we say in the news business, you're only as good as your sources. So we focus quite a bit on being able to circumvent the official public affairs bureaucracy.
If that sounds like a perverse game, that's because it's a perverse game, whose perversity is rooted in the fact that official spokesmen mouth the carefully parsed pronouncements of politicians who are worried about political consequences and therefore cannot be relied upon on any subject, including the weather. Even Leon Firth, the Clinton White House's Mr. Tightlips, acknowledges the credibility gap.
Dating back to Vietnam and Watergate, the press has had its reasons to be cynical about the motivations of government in wanting to keep information secret.
Even now, in the enlightened and transparent 21st century, the executive branch tends toward willy-nilly classification of innocuous information that properly belongs in the public domain. And when confronted by media organizations with leaked information for confirmation or comment, official Washington often reacts with reflexive cries of national security. This often leaves media organizations with difficult choices. When asked to kill or alter a story, they have to decide, is it really a matter of protecting military or intelligence personnel in the field, or is the government just trying to shield itself from embarrassment or political fallout? And if the story is held, will it show up the next day in the competition, maybe with a spin favorable to the government? The Washington Times' Bill Gertz.
I can remember in one case we had a story about a CIA officer who was having an affair with an Eastern European intelligence officer, and the CIA had asked that we not publish it, and we didn't. And within a week, the story came out in another news publication.
Some leaks, of course, are well tolerated by administrations because the administration itself, for political or diplomatic reasons, has engineered the leak. Journalist Scott Armstrong.
If you can control the information and you leak it out selectively, you can control the press and you can control the public debate. That's the idea.
Leon Firth.
And I recognize the press has got a problem because there's an infinite requirement for information and for visual images. But the country has a need. Now, is it the government's problem to solve this, or is it the press's problem to figure out how to deal with it?
It's a conundrum, all right. But one answer might be to look elsewhere in the world, where nobody dare leak, and nobody dare publish, and nobody knows what obscenity the regime is up to next. The citizens' protection is the responsibility of any government. Protection from the national government by a vigilant press and its confederates is a unique blessing of democracy.
Bob first reported that story for us back in 2001. Coming up, an orgy of self-congratulation on the media turns five.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a few of your letters. S. Ira Grossman of Los Angeles, California, says that we played softball with journalist Scott Armstrong last week. Quote, he never answered the question about why the New York Times waited so long to release the NSA story. My takeaway from his comments was that, quote, it was complicated, suggesting that the American public can't absorb the nuances of editorial concerns. You should be challenging people like Armstrong more vigorously.
On our report on stolen books, Fred Zeleny of Pittsburgh writes, I was a bookstore clerk for some time at Walden Books and Borders a couple of years ago in rural Maryland, and at that time we had two groups of books that were by default high theft risk items, books on the occult and copies of the Bible. The Bible was almost twice as commonly stolen, but that may have just been because we had a large biblical section and a larger Bible community. Upon catching the occasional shoplifter of either, we invariably got the same rationalization. A person shouldn't have to pay for this. Rather bad form on both cases, I feel.
Once again, our replay of the Wilhelm scream prompted kudos from listeners, writes Norm Herrmann of Etowah, North Carolina. Thanks for the broadcast of the Wilhelm Scream segment. It descended upon virgin ears. I will now spend the rest of my movie-going life obsessing with listening for this delightful sound effect. It's a phenomenon that is better known than I would have ever guessed. There's even a hard-working, based on their touring schedule, punk band, appropriately named after the aforementioned tortured yodel. They can be found right where you'd expect, at wilhelmscream.com.
And thanks to you for all your comments. Keep them coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
This week marks the 5th anniversary of On the Media. Actually, that's not strictly true. WNYC first launched On the Media 15 years ago as a local call-in show with former New York Times reporter Alex Jones.
That's here On the Media right after this news.
And then again in 1997 as a pre-recorded hour distributed nationally by NPR, hosted by longtime WNYC host Brian Lehrer.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brian.
And finally, in January 2001, it was retooled and launched yet again, this time with a bigger staff and a big ambition to redefine the media beat. We needn't have bothered. The ever-exploding beat has forced us to continually redefine the show. Mark Jerkowitz, longtime media critic now back at the Boston Phoenix after many years at the Boston Globe, has been on the beat longer than most.
When I began to do media criticism in 1987, it was a very lonely profession. Media criticism was really very much a creature of the alternative press, columns like Don't Quote Me in the Boston Phoenix or Press Clips in the Village Voice. It consisted of people like myself who essentially were kind of self-appointed arbiters of good journalism, who mostly stood as sort of a watchdog over the big mainstream media in our own communities.
A very lonely profession indeed, where puny Davids aim slingshots at the media Goliaths in their markets and rarely draw blood. Meanwhile, Goliath kept mum about how he went about his business.
You had really no media criticism to speak of in the mainstream media, and very little transparency. It's always kind of been my hypothesis that if a Jason Blair case or even a Judy Miller case had happened 20 years ago, we would have read about it about a paragraph without a byline somewhere on, you know, page 22 of the paper, and that would have been the way it was dealt with.
No more. The mainstream media fortress has been now and forever breached. But how, when, and why did that happen? Former OTM host Brian Lehrer hosts a daily call-in show on WNYC.
You know, I had mixed feelings when I was first asked to host On the Media, because on the one hand, I was very, very interested in media, always have been. On the other hand, I thought that that might have been just kind of a thumb-sucking impulse because I was somebody who worked in the media. So I was really kind of surprised when just a few months after I started hosting the show, the Monica Lewinsky story broke, and it seemed like suddenly the whole world was obsessing not just on the president and his young intern, but on the media coverage and the myriad media angles surrounding that story.
I noticed that, too, from my perch as NPR's first full-time media reporter. Suddenly, my marginal beat was headline news because the Lewinsky scandal was also a media scandal.
It really, in a way, did give rise to the modern polarized age in which lots of people on both the left and the right believe that the media are biased, incompetent, or not somehow reflecting reality as they see it.
The Washington Post's Howard Kurtz, widely regarded as the dean of media reporters.
I remember talking to Sam Donaldson during the Lewinsky period, and he was very much in the camp of where's the outrage? There were a lot of journalists in Washington who were angry at Bill Clinton, who felt betrayed. And meanwhile, much of the country was certainly not happy with the sordid behavior that Clinton exhibited in the Oval Office, saw that he had lied, but felt that he had lied about a matter, sex, that was not germane to his running the country. And so you had this huge split that dominated all media discourse for more than a year. And you had this public backlash in many quarters against the journalists who didn't quite understand why more people didn't share their outrage at Bill Clinton's behavior.
If the Lewinsky scandal gave the public a reason to distrust the media, technology was about to give it the means to talk back. Brian Lehrer.
They used to say anybody who can set yourself up with a printing press can run a newspaper. Now anybody who can set yourself up with some blogging software, which is pretty easy to do, can set yourself up as a journalist or a commentator. And what's the first thing that people who set themselves up as bloggers often want to write about? How bad a job the mainstream media is doing, necessitating the existence of them.
Blogs helped bring down media heavyweights like CBS anchor Dan Rather and CNN news chief Eason Jordan. During the last elections, one blog launched an Adopt a Journalist program, which scrutinized the words of selected campaign reporters. You can even download podcasts of homegrown media crit like this one.
And it's unbelievable. Like, the coverage is completely different in Canada than it is here in the States.
Alex Jones, director of the Joan Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy, hosted this show in its first incarnation as a local live call-in.
I think that one of the problems is that on the web, media criticism tends to be not real criticism, but polemicism. That's not the way I look at what valuable media criticism is, which is, you know, let's look at this with an open mind, with as much intellectual honesty and rigor as we can, and try to understand what the hell happened.
When the world is shining the light on you, perhaps the best response is to shine that light on yourself first. Increasingly, news outlets hire ombudsmen to investigate the public's complaints. The New York Times is on its second so-called public editor since Jason Blair. Transparency is not just a new media fashion. It's a life jacket designed to keep news operations afloat in a sea of distrust. Now, news anchors have blogs, news shows have blogs, even a news network, CBS, has a blog. And media people everywhere are eager to explain why they do what they do, right down to the camera angles chosen for political debates. Britt Hume on Fox.
There's a thing we have to worry about in television called headroom. And that is, when you're trying to match shots side by side, one of the things you do is you give both parties the same amount of headroom in the shot. Because of Carrie's height within the frame, his picture was necessarily bigger. And the result was you had more lectern and less bush, and Carrie's shot the other way around.
So, amid the internal watchdogs and the external blogs, has a show like ours lost its purpose? The truth is, 5 years ago we felt like we had the field to ourselves, and now we find we're regularly scooped by The Daily Show. Alex Jones says there is still a place for On the Media in the exploding media universe.
I think that is the kind of media criticism that will always have a market, because I think people are interested in this stuff.
On the other hand...
Well, you know, I liked it better when I was doing it.
I'm Katia Rogers, senior producer of the current version of On the Media. To end this anniversary show, we really wanted to play some clips, but Bob and Brooke could not be persuaded to toot their own horns. So we, the staff, have decided to play you a few of our favourite moments. First, Bob, with former White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer.
I want to pull back a little bit and ask you about the difficult position that a press secretary is placed in. Now, you obviously don't want to be standing there getting caught in a lie, but there's truth, Ari, and there's the whole truth. In court, you have to put your hand on a Bible and swear to tell the whole truth. Could you have done that before your daily press briefings?
Absolutely. I don't know why there should be a presumption not to. Well, let me make a very important caveat to that. There are truths that I never discussed with the press, of course.
This is Brooke arm wrestling with CNN President Jonathan Klein.
Let's talk about Monday, May 2nd. CNN Daybreak, The Rundown had Runaway Bride, American Morning, Runaway Bride could face criminal charges. Live from CNN, Runaway Bride back home, Crossfire, should Runaway Bride face charges. Anderson Cooper, Paula Zahn, Larry King, Aaron Brown, all of them devoted at least part of their program to Jennifer Wilbanks, the Runaway Bride. And Jonathan, I have to ask you, does this fit into the roll-up-your-sleeves storytelling that you have in mind?
Well, sure. I mean, the New York Times covered the Runaway Bride, too, and I'm sure I heard a story about it on NPR.
It was way buried in the New York Times.
Well, we can quibble over degree.
In this next clip, Bob probes the psyche of MSNBC host Dan Abrams.
All right, now, with apologies in advance, I'm going to ask you a completely impertinent question. You went to law school, you're a lawyer. You now have a your own show on a national cable network, and you're doing wall-to-wall coverage of the Lacey Peterson case. Dan, is this really how you want to make a living?
Yeah. Well, I'm laughing because, you know, it's on the one hand a stupid question, and on the other hand, toned down a little bit and asked in a slightly sort of more mature way is actually a very good question.
This is Brooke speaking with photojournalist Nick Hughes. The interview was supposed to be about the film he made in Rwanda, but it was really about remorse.
It's obvious that you came away with an enormous burden and a sense of responsibility that you don't feel you fulfilled and that the rest of the Western community in Rwanda certainly didn't fulfill. And you made this film. So my question is, can you leave it alone now?
Well, the film gives me an opportunity to speak about Rwanda, but I don't get the opportunity to go back and stop by the side of the road and pick up a child who's going to be murdered by the Interahamwe and take him out of the country to safety. And nor does anybody else get that opportunity to do that again. And nobody said anything about stopping it happening next time. So, no, I don't think there is anything really to feel positive about or redeemed about. Not at all. The genocide is the opposite of redemption. There is no redemption. You can't go back. Those people are dead, and it will happen again.
Recently, Bob spoke with former New York Times reporter Judy Miller, prompting a positive response from listeners. From Judy, not so much.
You've acknowledged that your WMD reporting in several material instances, got it wrong. But you've also said that the story is only as good as its sources.
Right.
To put the question in plain language, Judy, were you played for a chump by these sources, Ahmed Chalabi in particular?
You know, first of all, I'm not going to be insulted by your question, but I think that the sources that I relied on were reliable. They had been reliable in the past. I'm not going to discuss who they were, though many of them were actually identified by name in my stories. Moreover, those stories were heavily edited. They just didn't dance their way into the New York Times. As the editor's note acknowledged, everybody's wrong if your sources are wrong.
I love this clip. Brooke speaking to reporter Pam Constable in Kabul about the controversial appearance of women on Afghan TV.
You talk about an election season in Afghanistan. Of course, we have one here, and we also have an argument over broadcast standards that won't seem to go away. From where you stand, how does Janet Jackson's little problem seem to you?
You know, I'm sorry, Brooke, but I have no idea what you're talking about.
It's been dominating the headlines here. During the halftime show at the Super Bowl, Justin Timberlake reached over and...
Who is Justin Timberlake? I'm in the mountains of Central Asia. Who is Justin? Who are these people?
I really envy you.
And finally, some of what you hear on the program is recorded in the wee small hours of Friday mornings, like listener letters. Here's what that sounds like.
Before that, my radio usage consisted of only a few rock stations when I commuted. Then I found out about a hair. Then I found out about
Harry Prone.
Harry. Harry Prone companion. Okay. All right.
Harry Prone. That's a parody of
Okay. Can you take, Bob, if you don't shut up, you're going to have to turn off your mic.
I'm sorry, but for God's sake, Brooke, Harry Prone companion, what am I supposed to do?
There's media all around us, media big and small.
There are media that are hard to kill, like in that movie by Seagal.
There's so much media everywhere, it's hard to find relief.
There's media in the food we eat and in the air we breathe.
I don't know what you're saying, but I know this much is true.
Our name is on the media, and we're the show for you.
On the media.
Tune it in and turn it on.
On the media.
We've got the Punditron.
On the media.
We're your media watchdog.
On the media.
At onthemedia.org.
Media,
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 media
deserves a second look.
Media,
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 media.
That's why you've got Bob and Brooke.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had additional engineering help from Rob Christensen and editorial backup from Katie Holt and Kevin Schlottman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. And some more thanks to the people who helped build the show and then left: Janine Price, Mike Pesca, Arun Roth, and Dean Capello.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Happy anniversary, Brooke.
Happy anniversary to you too, Bob.
Cheers, baby cakes.
Baby cakes?
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.